It's my pleasure to introduce Hal Tossig. Thank you for your message last night, Hal. Hal has a mic on, so it'll be easy to record and also for you to hear. If you do have questions, when Fireside gets full, sometimes it's really difficult to hear people in the audience. So use your outside voice when you ask a question. Or Hal will repeat, and that's so everybody can hear. And tomorrow there should be chairs upstairs. They're on order. From the Mavericks.
You were wondering if you were being punished.
No, never, Kate. So that hopefully by Tuesday morning the chairs will be up there. So it's my pleasure to introduce Hal. I think Hal is the only person that I can say that I know that has written 14 books. I think that's true. So thank you for coming the 13th time to teach at Holden. Hal is a retired university professor and a United Methodist pastor, and we're all thrilled that he can serve our faculty. So thank you.
And Sharon, thank you so much for all of your work. I wouldn't be able to do this without you, so thank you.
My pleasure.
Us either.
Just a little bit of prequel about our work together this week. My pedagogy tends to be talk for 10 minutes, at open the floor for 5 minutes through the hour. I need to reassure you that I can't actually teach very well without that interface back and forth with you. So I would encourage you to, at any point, offer your questions, thoughts, and protests. We can't work well enough together, and we can't learn enough unless that happens. So I'll ask you that. You'll find that I think that being an intellectual and being someone who's deeply involved in spiritual practice are not contradictory. And so we will find ourselves pretty deep in both territories throughout the week. So, on to the topic. So I'm teaching two different courses this week, one at this time every morning, and then one at 5:45 to 7:15, I think, a little longer. And that is on the future of worship. That is a part of a three-part series that we're doing. I started in February on the President's Day programming here and will end in August. And this will be a three-part look at the future of worship, not just here at Holden, but actually explicitly also about the future of worship at Holden, as well as larger worship. That's going to be taught as a kind of seminar, which means everybody's going to be talking a lot. I've done seminars with 50 or 60, so I'm not afraid of that. I invite you to, if you're interested in the failure or the successes of worship, please join us in the evening. One other thing about just learning together, it's a goofy task for one to be a student of the ancient Mediterranean and Near East and of the biblical field. Because when I was taught in graduate school about how to do that, it seemed like about a third of all words, all sentences, started with something like, "and we know this." And I don't do that at all in my teaching of graduate school, but I would want to say, so I was taught, and you will catch me on this regularly, I was taught to be presumptuous and arrogant in the way I think I know. Because it's ridiculous to think you know much at all about something 2,000 or more years ago, something from across a distance, not only of time, but of culture, in which so many different cultures intercede between our cultures and the cultures of the first century, let's say. So you need to settle into, if you can, or at least just smile, or frown, both are appropriate. When you hear me say something like, we know this, just assume that 50% of the times I say that, and probably of the times I say other things, I'm lying. And I'm not trying to lie, but I've been trained to lie, and I'm arrogant enough to do that. So that's, again, why we need to have your full support back and forth with your thinking. Because it happens in this room, certainly in the last 12 sessions, 12 times I've been in Holden, this room almost always has a bunch of you who know more about the ancient world than I do, and you don't think you do. So that's that. Just a little bit then about the goofy title for Living Word this week. I've chosen two Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Luke, to study together. And I want to say just a few words about that as to why I've done that. One is, those of us who are in churches, and I hope most of you are, many of you are not, those of you in churches often follow weekly a thing called the lectionary, which is some kind of edict from the sky of what stuff you're supposed to read every Sunday in order. And this year is basically the word from some kind of on high, is that one reads Luke. This is called Year C. And so that's why I chose Luke. I like Luke too. But we'll be reading Luke just because a lot of people will be reading Luke. Secondly, we're reading Luke because Luke is in many ways, a wisdom gospel. That is, it has a lot of wisdom in that. And that does not mean it's smart. That means that there's a kind of literature in the ancient world called wisdom literature that is very specific in what it does and what it doesn't do. There's a bunch of wisdom literature in the Bible, but it always gets last place. Hardly ever do you find it in the lectionary, per se. Luke is not a complete wisdom gospel. It has a number of other genres that fit in. But I chose that alongside of the Gospel of Thomas, which you all know is not in the Bible, because it was discovered in 1945 and is perhaps the most thorough wisdom text we have from the Jesus movies. And although in 1945, when it was discovered, we're just barely getting started on understanding the Gospel of Thomas. I suspect, well, let me just raise... have your hands raised. How many of you have read some of the Gospel of Thomas? Great, yeah. I was going to guess half, so you're over half in that regard. Is my mic working? I'm feeling, okay, good.
Yeah, fine.
That's good.
Thanks. So the Gospel of Thomas, at first was, when it was discovered in the Nag Hammadi library in the desert of Egypt, it was quite regularly critiqued as something that was Gnostic and heresy. And that was just the way we scholars responded to all of the new literature that's been discovered in the last 150 years from the early Jesus movements, because we weren't taught about it, and so we're really defensive about it. So anytime we can put it down, we do. In my career, I've found halfway through that I was taught very unhelpfully about all of these new discoveries. And so I went back to school and learned my sixth ancient language, because almost all of this is in Coptic. And I learned Coptic because it became clear to me that we need to think with a lot of this literature. Gospel Thomas is probably the most famous of these discoveries in the last 150 years. So it has a fair amount of literature on it already, but we're really still trying to get away from the first 20 years of my type and trying to put it down rather than trying to hear where it's good and not so good, as most literature of Jesus and Jesus movements are. They have a lot of good and some not so good. Okay, I'm going to stop here and see if there's something that I've already said that's a lie or interesting enough for you to have a thought or protest about.
Where did you say that they found the Book of Thomas?
Where did
they find it?
Yeah, they found it in Middle Egypt. In 1945, the short version is, was found by some farmers in a big jar with 51 other new discoveries from the early Jesus movements. It took a while for people other than farmers to know about it. The farmers burned some of it because they wanted to warm their house in the winter. That's where it was found, we knew that it existed. That is, there are other documents that from the ancient world that say, and you know how the Gospel of Thomas says, and we would say up until 1945, no, we don't know about the Gospel. And then we discovered it.
What language was it originally written in?
Well, we don't really know. Okay. That's going to be my standard answer to most of the questions when I'm honest. But right now, the only entire copy of the Gospel of Thomas is in Coptic. Since we found it, we found that a whole bunch of fragments of other things that we already had were from the Gospel of Thomas. We just didn't know it. And there are a number of, I would say probably now at least 30 partial documents in Greek that are also parts of the Gospel of Thomas. That suggests a possibility that since most of the Gospels are written in Greek first, that this too was written in Greek, and the only copy we have of everything from the Gospel of Thomas in Coptic is a translation. I can tell you that I'm confused about that question, in that the Coptic is really quite wonderful. I mean, the quality of the Coptic is not some stupid translation. Other thoughts, questions? Yes.
Just, I'm not of the academic world, and it just seems like a miracle that this has all come together. Or that we, I don't know, it's like making glasses so you can see. You know, there's people who are much smarter than I am that put this together.
A lot, when I'm teaching around the country, I often say the discovery of more than 100 new documents of the early Christ movements in the last 100-plus years is the most important thing that's happened to the Bible in the last 1,500 years. We've found more than we have. Yeah, no, it's amazing. Yeah, and therefore, it has wonder and tragedy attached to it. Okay, so one step further. Let me lie to you thoroughly about what I think I know about these two Gospels that we're going to be studying alongside of one another. The Gospel of Luke, in the last 30 years of scholarship, has been pushed later and later. Now I would say at least a plurality of all scholars think it was written in the second century, around 120. I was taught that it was written in the 80s. It is probably the first gospel that was not written for a particular community, but was written for a larger movement. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and Mary, and other gospels, we're almost certain were written for specific communities that were in one place. It looks like the Gospel of Luke is the most ambitious in the canon because it's trying to speak at once with a whole bunch of different communities. The fact that it's called Luke is an accident. None of the early documents have the word Luke in them. And it's only in the title when it's the later documents. So we don't know who wrote it. You will hear me saying Luke all the time. In the 1980s, when we found a whole bunch of material in the Gospel of Luke that had extra information about women leaders in the early church, we thought for a while that that Luke was a woman, or that the Gospel of Luke was written by a woman. That's in recent years gotten more complicated, and we don't know what we're talking about. Either way, the Gospel of Luke was written by. We know that that person was highly educated. So, for instance, and elite. So the author of the Gospel of Luke is an elite person. For instance, Luke is the only gospel in the canon where Jesus knows how to read and write. In Matthew, Mark, and John, there's no evidence that Jesus reads or writes. But Luke makes him smarter, or at least more educated. He's got better houses. He acts like he and the people he's talking to are wealthy, and he's a strong advocate for the poor. Or excuse me, she. So that's just a thumbnail sketch overview of the Gospel of Luke. The Gospel of Thomas is all sayings of Jesus. So 114 short chapters of saying. So in other words, Jesus does nothing but talk in the Gospel of Thomas. Nothing happens in the Gospel of Thomas. Just Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said. That means that it is what we call a sayings gospel. Now we found other sayings gospels. And many people think that there was a sayings gospel behind Luke and Matthew, meaning only sayings, nothing happens. So for instance, that means that the Gospel of Thomas seems not to know or care about the death or resurrection of Jesus. Let me say that again. Isn't this amazing that we have a gospel that actually thinks of itself as complete good news? Four people, and it was in different languages all over the Mediterranean, and it didn't seem to either know or think it was interesting to know about Jesus' death and resurrection. So this is a stunning, different kind of thinking. This, of course, is right at the heart of wisdom. That is, this is a gospel that is a piece of wisdom literature. like Proverbs, or like the book of wisdom in First Testament, like Job, all those kinds of literature that are known in the Near East and Mediterranean, and are ancient and contemporary with the Gospel of Thomas, those are all known quantities of a kind of way of thinking. Now we have a one full of Jesus speaking. Who wrote the Gospel of Thomas? Almost certainly not Thomas. Now, if we went through, if we were teaching any other of the 175 texts written in the first two centuries, I would say the same thing. Except for Paul and a couple of other people, we don't know the writers and their names or exactly who they were. Thomas's lore is that as a person and as a follower of Jesus is known as a wisdom person. So that's where we got the title or the supposed authorship of the Gospel of Thomas. But there's no real evidence there's just no reason for us to think with only one full and several partial copies of the Gospel of Thomas that we know who wrote it. We think that Thomas, no, we're really mixed up about when Thomas was written. So when it was first discovered, almost all scholars agreed that it was written after 150. Many of us now think that was simply a way of us trying to put it down, because it was written to make it look later. A lot of the early students of the Gospel of Thomas said surely it is copying Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Mm-hmm. Now it's almost sure that it's not. And the relationship between those three Gospels and Thomas is very complicated and really interesting and actually helpful. So when we are studying this week on Luke and Thomas, you need to know we are doing first-rate literature to think more complexly about the relationship between those documents and to find really new stuff about it. So now I would say there are, I think John Dominic Crossan, I think he would say between 70 and 85 would be the dates for Thomas. I would say the one copy that we have, I would tend probably to say something like 90, but you will know that I lie. So that's the status of the what we can say about these two Gospels. Let's stop and hear from you on any of this. Yes?
What pushed Luke's date back or forward?
Oh, yeah, great question.
I've always been an 80 man myself.
Yeah, right. No, that's the way I learned. It's a lot, mostly comparisons between Matthew and Luke, both of which we thought were written in the 80s, mm-hmm. in my old day. It looks like there's a number of reasons that when you see, although Matthew and Luke are not the same in their context, when they are some of the same, it looks like there are additions to Luke which make it later. Secondly, Luke is very, very interested in the relationship between the early Christ movements and Roman violence. And Luke is the only of the canonical gospels that regularly gives you information about what's going on with the emperor or with the Roman government in the text itself. Mm-hmm. So those are two of the ways. There are also then more boring and complicated things about the various manuscripts. Yes.
Do they self-describe themselves as gospels, or is that a literature term?
I only use the word gospel where it's used in a text. So
in the gospel box, does it say
says it's the gospel, as does, for instance, the gospel of Mary. So for instance, now one thinks that a gospel is a story about Jesus. But the gospel of Thomas thinks it's a gospel, and it doesn't care about stories at all.
But is that a kind of literature that they're saying?
See, this is what happens in this room. Thank you. So the word gospel in Greek and Coptic means the good news.
Right.
The first person that we know of that time to use the term good news is Augustus Caesar. About his what he offers. So Augustus Caesar says, I bring you good news of peace and justice. And of course he didn't. He squashed all kinds of but he was the one who said, I am a God. I bring you good news for the whole world. So the word good, well, and then Paul uses the word gospel about his writings, which aren't what we would say are gospels at all. So Paul is the first Christ follower that we know that uses it, and we think he uses it ironically in critique of the emperor. So in other words, the emperor has every reason to say, I bring you good news, because he's the wealthiest and powerful, most powerful person that anyone has known in that time. And he's done a lot of good things, built a lot of gospels, won a lot of wars, read a lot of books. And of course, it's the imperial people who crucified Jesus as a punishment. So Paul then wants to turn that upside down and say, yeah, Jesus is a secret emperor that was tortured. So that's kind of where we're thinking. Yes?
Well, you said that Thomas was the saints gospel, but then you also said there were parts that were destroyed or burned, or maybe there's parts that haven't been found or whatever. So is there any chance that maybe there was more to Thomas, but it hasn't been found or destroyed or burned? And then, of course, I wasn't listening real well. Did you say there was more than one author to Thomas, or they just think it's one?
Oh, the hard question's coming right and left. That's good. So I actually misspoke. When I said there were more, some of it was burned, I was talking about the jar and the 52 documents. So some of those were burned, partially, but Thomas is almost complete.
Oh, okay.
So, and Thomas has a beginning and an end. Okay. So Thomas said, basically, this is the beginning, this is the end. So I would say whereas some of the Nag Hammadi jar, I call it the Jesus jar, that was found, some of them have about two-thirds burned or lost. But Thomas is quite complete. Yes. Paul.
Academics are so eager to explore, seems to be kind of fearlessly. Is there resistance in the institutional church to, come on, let's not go there. We've got it all figured out now.
Yeah, but that's the way both scholars and church leaders responded to these new discoveries regularly.
Yeah.
I can remember for the first half of my career, when I would be in public talking about things, someone would come up afterwards and say, hey, I read in the New York Times that this new discovery was made. And I would constantly say to groups and individuals, don't bother, it's just secondhand and heresy. Because that's what I was taught. Only after almost a decade of people in the public saying, hey, I heard this, or hey, I read this. And then finally, when I would say the stupid things I was saying, they would say, I read this and I love it. So I was really slow in learning that, but yes, there still is that. So for instance, the main thing that's happening in the last 20 years is the evangelical movement has changed its graduate studies to emphasize these studies and put them down. So what you have now is one of the most fierce and lively funding of this literature in order to put it in its place. Wow. So I would say right now you have more professors trying to say this stuff is wrong than right. And that's because what happened, of course, is the public has got a wonderful appetite for this material and they've read it. And so evangelical Christianity has said, we're in trouble. We've got to work hard against it. I have been an evangelical. I love a lot of evangelicalism, but this I don't.
Why does this mean trouble?
Why does what mean trouble? Oh, for the evangelical, yeah. Because the inerrancy of the Bible is in question. If you, for instance, now we have 22 gospels that have been, including the four, and people are doing what we're doing in studying them together. For instance, I want to say, let's read one of these together, not to say what's the best and not, but just to find the best and the worst in both. Mm-hmm. So that's what's been. I have a handout I will every day. Let's look at the big handout. So this is a copy of the Gospel Talmud. This is for the week. Bring this every week, or every day, just to class. And yes, and some of you are doing the right thing. Open it this way, otherwise you'll be going to get upside down. Again. So you can open it this way, and on each page you'll be seeing a whole set of. I've also given you my short intro to the Gospel of Thomas that I wrote in the New Testament. So you'll see at the beginning there is an introduction to the Gospel of Thomas. I'm going to try to leave out almost everything I say in this, just because I want to spend our time together otherwise. So please read that, and then you have the whole Gospel of Thomas, all 114 short. Chapters or verses. But then here's today's handout, and I'd like to go over that next as much as we can. And so let's look at the top here. And here I'm trying to begin for us. It's probably going to take us half of the week to think we know what wisdom literature is. It's not an easy answer. But here I've given you samples of ancient wisdom, just a sample. So for instance, the teachings of the Tao on the left hand in ancient China, there's a saying of Lao Tzu. Right below that, there's an ancient Egyptian proverb. In the middle there is one of the teachings of the Buddha. Right below is a teaching of Socrates from ancient Greece. At the top is the Old Testament, so-called Book of Proverbs. That's all wisdom literature as well. And then there is the sayings of Sextus, one of the other 52 books found in the Jesus jar in the desert. I just saw someone having read the sayings of Sextus. I think it's so cool. If a tyrant threatens you, then especially remember God. What we see here, and I don't want to make this a world religions course, but what you see here is that all over the ancient world, for a long time, for thousands of years, you have this kind of practice of people trying to say what things mean by saying a small text, a small saying. So in all kinds of places, including Israel, you have what we would call sages. So that's a wise person. And often someone will start thinking about what everything means, or what's smart, or what's good to think through, and get into it so much that they will then, that will be their work for their life. So you have a lot of people, I would say like Jesus, and maybe like Solomon, who got so far into, I want to think with the public about what makes sense. And they do it in a way that has almost no story. We're going to talk about the difference between story wisdom and sayings wisdom as we go through. But what a provisional suggestion I would want to make along with most of my colleagues is that wisdom is a kind of search for truth and knowledge that doesn't go on forever, that is fairly succinct, but goes, so a sage will usually have something in two or three sentences, go home and think about it, and have another saying in 2 days or something, or maybe a week, or maybe a month or a year. And often sages, these are men and women, across the ancient world, they mainly like to have these as a conversation with the public. So the main place that this happens is in the marketplace across cultures. Not all. There's some that found schools in which a teacher says to people in the marketplace, now if you want to continue the conversation, we're having a meal and it's going to go on for 3 hours. So that's what I just said is a snapshot, a big snapshot of wisdom, and leaves out almost everything we need to know. Look down, if you would, to the middle section of the handout. There are kinds of ancient wisdom that are, this is not everything, but it's giving main categories. Proverb. A proverb is a short, pithy saying in general use, stating a general truth or a piece of advice. So, for instance, if you have a Bible and you want to read the Book of Proverbs, you'll have a whole bunch of them. Mostly from chapter 9 on, by the way. Chapter 1 to 9 in the Book of Proverbs is another topic that we will talk about. That's mostly about the figure of wisdom, the person of wisdom, whom I was lucky enough to have in the lectionary for last night's conversation. I would want to say that Proverbs generally are the ones that stay the longest and are the easiest to understand. Whereas aphorism, there are a lot of aphorisms by sages. That's a statement of truth or opinion expressed in a concise, terse, and witty manner, often including irony and complication. So for instance, a typical aphorism is Jesus' parable is a parable and an aphorism at the same time. Oh no, here's an aphorism that's not a parable by Jesus. It's not what goes into you that is dirty. It's what comes out of you. No one laughed. If you had gotten it, you would know how aphoristic that is, right? What comes out of us? And where is it? And is it dirty? So this is potty humor by Jesus aphoristically. So that's an aphorism which has a twist to it and is unexpected and more complicated than you expected it to be. Treatise. I put this in because it contradicted what I just said. There are some treatises that are considered wisdom. Their exposition or argument, including a methodological discussion of the facts and principles involved and conclusions reached. In other words, this is longer. So for instance, in the New Testament, one would want to say that Jesus speaks in treatises. You know how Jesus goes on and on and on in the Gospel of John, whereas the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and Thomas are short, pithy things that stop. Jesus will go on for a page and a half or so about the same topic, more or less, in the Gospel of John. So Jesus is a wise treatise giver in John. Parable, a short story or image that expresses or undermines a general truth. So this is either just a picture or a little story that messes with you. So here, for instance, the one in both Thomas and Luke of the parable of the mustard seed. What shall we compare to the realm of God? It's like a mustard seed that grows into a great bush, and all the birds of the air come to it. Anybody who knows a mustard seed plant knows that is an exaggeration. And mustard is not important in the Near East. It's a weed. So it's like, what should we compare the realm of God to? It's like a weed that grows and a bunch of birds fly into it. And not actually many do that. Not that many can fit in a mustard plant. So in other words, here you have Jesus wants to see the realm of God compared to something that's considered a weed. To open your minds to a broader idea of what God's kingdom might be. There are lots of parables beyond Jesus's. Okay, let me stop there for these two little inserts for questions or other thoughts. Yes?
I'm curious what would be the difference between wisdom literature and what's known as Gnostic stuff? Or is there really a reasonable explanation of what Gnostic is?
So the question is Gnostic and what the difference between wisdom and Gnostic. The really wonderful thing about that question is that both have their Greek words in particular. So the Greek word for wisdom is Sophia. And that's really interesting because wisdom becomes in the Bible a person. The word for knowledge in Greek is gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. So that's why your question is really important. A little bit beyond my pay grade, in that right now the field of studies, we scholars are having a big argument about whether there is such a thing as Gnosticism. Mm-hmm. Gnosticism was, for the people who taught me in 1723, we were taught that Gnosticism was a major early Christian heresy. Now that comes from the word gnosis, which means just wisdom, knowledge. So for instance, Paul thinks gnosis is fine. It's just like, is it good to know stuff? Yeah, it is. And here, and Paul will say, and these are the things you should know.
And don't some folks consider Paul a Gnostic?
Right, yes, exactly. So Gnostic is a smart person. In other words, the word gnostikos in Greek means somebody who has a lot of wisdom. In other words, by and large, in the first century, the word gnostikos or Gnostic is a positive. However, occasionally, and we all know this, when someone thinks they know a lot, you call them a know-it-all, right? So a gnostikos, a Gnostic, sometimes, rarely, in the first two centuries, means a know-it-all. So this is, right now, I would say, with the lead of Karen King at Harvard over the last 25 years, a lot of people have said Gnosticism, because the word Gnosticism, which is the word for the ancient heresy, doesn't exist in the early centuries. It was the word Gnosticism, that is, a system of this heresy, doesn't appear until the 1700s. And so a bunch of us now say Gnosticism is a later Christian word to characterize some of its enemies wrongly. So Gnostic, the difference between what is Gnostic and is simply, is it smart or not? Or is it knowledge in regular Greek? But it has become a Christian theological word. It puts people who know things down, which is a good thing sometimes, right? And not a good thing sometimes. So I would say my answer would be there is no such thing as Gnosticism. And we've got to rethink Gnosticism as a study entered, that really began in the 20th century. It was first mentioned in 1700, but calling ancient Christian literature Gnosticism, that happened in the 20th century. And I think that's because we were all afraid of all these new things that were being found. And I can show to you a lot people that are smarter than me that still think that there is such a thing as Gnosticism.
Hence your very respectable critique of Elaine Pagels.
Well, Elaine has changed.
Yeah.
Elaine Pagels has completely changed. I mean, 10 years ago, Elaine and I were in front of people debating this. Elaine now no longer allows her PhD students to use the word Gnosticism. So yeah, but Elaine really did so many wonderful things for the discovery of all of these new documents. But she was still in contact with that, what I would say, older thought. Yes.
From the way I remember being taught this stuff back in the day, in the 80s, whatever, not so much that Gnosticism yet was a formal category, but it's more of an attitude of secret knowledge that some of us you know, you ignorant people who only know in common knowledge don't know the secrets that we know. And so the esotericism, that was kind of that arrogant attitude that we know stuff that you common low people don't. Whereas the standard Christian gospel was presented as a public thing for everyone. And we're not keeping, you know, the real good stuff for ourselves.
This is a question. I should have said this earlier. I'm pretty good at saying, can we talk on a sidebar about this?
Yeah.
I would talk on the sidebar about this, but this is so much about Thomas, too, that I wanted to say a little bit more. Yes, that's beautifully said what we learned when we were in seminary, whatever. Yeah. The thing is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are full of secret knowledge. Okay. I mean, in fact, I would say Matthew has, Mark leads Mark and Luke in having a category of the secret of the Messiah. And Jesus regularly in Matthew, Mark, and Luke take his people aside and say, don't tell anybody. So the goofy thing of what we were taught is actually they would have had to include Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And what they were saying about Matthew, Mark, and Luke simply is not the case in the story itself. Okay, well, let me go on and get to the thing I was going to spend about 40 minutes on. So down at the bottom, I have given you excerpts of wisdom in both the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Luke. You can, if you are avoiding the beautiful outdoors and the fawns, you might look at a lot of these. We can catch up, but I want to see a couple of these. So let's look. Let's look at just Gospel of Thomas 2. That's easy to find. Would someone read Thomas 2 out loud, please, with a loud reading voice?
Jesus said, "Let the one who seeks continue seeking until he finds. When that one finds, he will be disturbed. And once that one is disturbed, he will become awed and will rule as a king over the all."
Let's sort of think about that for a moment, Lewis. So, this is, as we will probably have time even right now, this is like a text from the Gospel of Luke in which Jesus says, "Seek and you shall find. Knock and it will be opened to you." Right? So this is, and this is typical, of course, of a wisdom teaching. It's a sage says, look, seek it. You know, think more about it. If you're really feeling like you need to figure this out, seek it. The Book of Wisdom in the First Testament for Catholics and Episcopalians has this beautiful saying of wisdom herself: "If you're seeking her, she'll come straight to you." Those who are wise are people who keep seeking for more knowledge and for more wisdom. So Thomas and Luke agree together. But then this is twisted, isn't it? Right? So seek until he finds. And then when one finds, they will be disturbed. Now, how many in this room have had that happen? Right? It's something that happens a lot to us because we learn good things. By the way, I think the word "learn" is probably the best word for wisdom in our day. It's learning. It can be spiritual learning, it can be academic learning, all kinds of things. So here, succeeding in finding, learning, then disturbs us. And here Jesus says, that's a good thing. And then once one is disturbed, one will become awed. So this is a process that early on in the Gospel of Thomas is being proposed. Go through the seeking and finding, go through the disturbing, and keep working on it so that then you're in awe. Notice how awe is a combination of being overwhelmed and finding.
It seems to me putting these next to the word for disciples in the Synoptic Gospels is mathik, which is learner,
yeah.
Tended to be a lifelong learning process, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So even as we look at Mark and often are, you know, dumbfounded by the disciples never getting it, Thomas is saying it's normal.
Yeah. Oh, that N is deep. That's so important, by the way. I never get a chance to have folks know this as much, so thank you. So the word that is translated in our Bibles, disciple, should be student. The word disciple means student or learner. But a learner of a kind, Thomas would say, that involves being discerned. And involves, I mean, the further in this process you get, the more awed you are, which does not always mean in charge, right? That's like half in charge and half letting go.
One of the pillars of Holden Village is Gertrude Lundholm. And during the worship service, when you're supposed to share the peace, she would say, "May the peace of the Lord disturb you." Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And her son is here and has shared that in the service last night with some of the people he saw.
Oh, wonderful.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, that's great. That's perfect.
That's
way
wisdom.
The perfect way to end. I am a time Nazi. You have your precious time to do other things. Hope to see some of you tomorrow.
Thank you.